this is kind of scary, right? The Silicon Valley Bank went down, and the Signature Bank, and Credit Suisse, the big Swiss bank, and First Republic needs a bailout. Now, I tell you, there's never been a better time to have no money at all. That Signature Bank one, that was the one that was way into crypto. And that's when you know you're a bad bank. When you don't, you run out of imaginary money. That's... But the Republicans have figured out why the banks went under. They were too woke. I'm not kidding. That's what they're saying. Now, look, I'm no fan of woke, but come on. Even my dog has more than one bark. It's not like they were having drag queen deposit hour. apropos of this sort of, you see, there's a 5,000-mile-long blob of seaweed. Ooh, I know. It's going to hit the beaches in Florida, and I'm just waiting for DeSantis to say, well, the ocean is too woke. It's shocking what fish are learning in their schools. I don't know how this country keeps going with so much nuttiness. Here's something that I found very interesting today. New poll shows that two-thirds of Republican voters think that their own party, the Republicans, worked secretly with the liberals to make Biden president. I mean, of all the conspiracy theories, that is the craziest. Bipartisanship? Come on. I'll believe a lot of things. And on the other side of crazy, did you see what the San Francisco supervisors have done? They're backing reparations, if you're a black person in San Francisco, of $5 million. Really? No reaction? Okay. All right, let me keep going. You get $5 million, elimination of personal debt, of all tax burdens, a guaranteed annual income of $97,000 for 250 years. Wow, must be some health care involved there, too. And a home that you get for $1. And the... let's see who's clapping. The first to comment on this was George Santos, who said, as a black man...
Good morning. It is Wednesday, March the 22nd, and this is The True Conservative. Welcome to all the butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers out there. I'm Ron, your host, and the only true conservative in the United States today. So today, after the Serenity Prayer and the Star Spangled Banner, we will have Tucker Carlson, Squawk Box, Nonprofit News, Joe Rogan, Donald Trump, Mark Kay, The Rape of the Mind, Emotional Manipulation, George Lakoff, and No Free Lunch. All that and more when I get back. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing and remove your hats for the national anthem of the United States of America.
Thank you, thank you. And now, there's no free lunch. 250 Economic Truths by David Bahnsen.
The theories of the social sciences do not consist of laws in the sense of empirical rules about the behavior of objects definable in physical terms. All that the theory of the social sciences attempts is to provide a technique of reasoning which assists us in connecting individual facts, but which, like logic or mathematics, is not about the facts. It can, therefore, and this is the second point, never be verified or falsified by reference to facts. F.A. Hayek. This lack of ability to verify or falsify the theories of today's social scientists is the most frightening component of organized social management. Failures do not worry those who believe they can masterfully control the affairs of society, because the lack of specificity and factual foundation gives them a never-ending wiggle room to adjust, to modify, to move on, all without accountability for the failure of their broken theories. They want all the benefits of practicing a science, authority, credibility, presumption of expertise, but none of the accountability. It's a pretty good deal for them and a lousy one for the rest of us.
And that was There's No Free Lunch by David Bahnsen. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. Now about 30 seconds of Donald Trump.
Our enemies are desperate to stop us because they know that we are the only ones who can stop them, and they know it very strongly. And they're looking at the polls where, not me, but we are up by so much. They can't even believe it. We won twice, and now we've got to win a third time. They know that we can defeat them. They know that we will defeat them. But they're not coming after me. They're coming after you. I'm just standing in their way.
And that was Donald Trump telling us that he is standing in their way, and he always will. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. A little bit of Tucker Carlson. He's with Victor Davis Hanson, some professor. So just a few seconds of it, and then I got a comment.
Would do. So they have this weaponized criminal justice system and this criminalizing of politics. And I don't know how long it can continue, and you can still have a republic, because the cynicism is at pandemic proportions.
Yes. The cynicism, I think it's so nicely put. You hear people who kind of believed in the system for dismissing it as fake, and that's not a good thing at all. Victor Davis Hanson, I appreciate your perspective on this. Thank you very much.
So, again, the question is, because what they're talking about is, of course, Donald Trump and the possibility that he's going to be indicted and put on trial or whatever. So the question is, how did we get here? No answer. What are they going to do about it? No answer. What should we do about it? No answer. So we're just left here, and then these same fools are going to be wondering, well, why is nobody doing anything? Because these, and I like Tucker Carlson, but he's making a big mistake here. Him and Victor David Hanson are making a mistake by being neutral, by acting as if they have no skin in the game. The left is going ahead and tearing the country apart, according to these two, and they just sit there and very calmly talk about it and describe it. And then they go to a commercial break. And then you want to wonder why it is nobody else in the country is doing anything? Gee, go figure. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. And now, the rape of the mind, the lie detector.
Lie detector. Hypnotism and narcoanalysis are only two of the current devices that can be used as instruments of enforced intrusion into the mind. The lie detector, which has already been used as a tool for mental intimidation, is another. This apparatus, useful for psychobiological experimentation, can indicate, through writing down meticulously the changes in the psychogalvanic reflex, that the human guinea pig under investigation reacts more emotionally to certain questions than to others. True, this overreaction may be the reaction to having told a lie, but it may also be an innocent person's reaction to the emotion-laden situation or even to an increased fear of unjust accusation. The interpersonal processes between interrogator and testee have just as much influence on the emotional reactions and changes in the galvanic reflex as feelings of inner guilt and confession. This experiment only indicates inner turmoil and hidden repressions, with all their doubt and ambiguities. It is not, in fact, a lie detector, although it is used as such, D. MacDonald. As a matter of fact, the pathological liar and the psychopathic conscienceless personality may show less reaction to this experiment than normal people do. The lie detector is more likely to become a tool of coercion in the hands of men who look more for a powerful magic in every instrument than a means of getting at the truth. As a result, even the innocent can be fooled into false confession.
And that was The Lie Detector from The Rape of the Mind by Joost Mierlo. So a little bit more from Squawk Box, another example.
Find out that the financial turmoil dies down. They can always raise rates a little more quickly in following meetings. But if they raise rates and financial turmoil becomes substantially more significant, it is going to look a little bit awkward that they were raising into that financial turmoil.
Okay, so Eric, that's what you think should happen. What do you think will happen?
So the markets are saying they're likely to raise by 25 basis points.
So I'm going to cut it off right there because it really doesn't matter what his answer is. What he should have said is, it doesn't matter. I'm not in the prediction business. What's most important and what's just singularly important is what should happen, and leave it at that. But again, the guy that's interviewing him is a lefty, and he wants everything nice and neutral because if neutrality, then socialism. So this is the way that he corrupts the culture, helps to shape reality, corrupt the culture, get in your psyche, and get you to think and act like a socialist. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. And a little bit of Joe Rogan, about 35 seconds.
The culture shift between right and left authoritarianism, and now people don't recognize that if you just stop looking at it in terms of red and blue, look at the actions, whether it's war, suppression of free speech, pharmacological interventions that are mandatory, right. whatever the fuck it is, that used to all be associated with the authoritative right, the authoritarian right. And now those things are being embraced by the left. And I just think it's just an ideology thing. And I think we get confused and we think, we're on the right side. We're on the right side. And if it's our side that's saying this, for sure that's the right thing to do. And no one's critically thinking about this. The culture shift.
So that was Joe Rogan about the culture shift and how things have changed. And it seems in a lot of ways that the right has gone left and the left has gone right. When you think about the 60s, and if you get the opportunity to study a little bit about the 60s, The 60s, the people were very freewheeling. They were very had a lot of fun. They were younger individuals, the hippies and yippies, and they were always making fun of the establishment and the people in the establishment. And now these people that used to be 60s radicals are now become the very same people that they used to criticize. They're the ones that are now taking themselves very seriously, that they're very authoritarian and whatnot. So he's got a point about that. I also made the point that we keep thinking that when we're talking, because we could talk about extremes, politics is on a line, it's linear, that you move left and left and left, and you can, I guess, there's no end to how far left you can go or how far right. But I think that it's a circle. And that if you keep moving left, 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 eventually you come around and you start becoming a righty. And same thing if you're moving right. If you're moving more and more conservative, eventually you're going to come around the other side of the circle and start becoming a lefty. So anyways, that was Joe Rogan. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. And now a little bit of Mark Kay.
Spoken out about Donald Trump's pending imminent arrest. Besides Donald Trump, one of them is Elon Musk. First of all, he said, look, if Donald Trump is arrested, he will win in a landslide victory. Elon Musk, he knows what he's talking about. He understands how people don't like their political leaders being jailed for no other reason than, well, they have a different viewpoint. Chris Rock was speaking at an event in Washington, D.C. the other day, and he said the same thing. He was talking to a group of Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi and a bunch of folks from the Biden administration. He basically called them all stupid. He said, if you arrest Donald Trump, you're going to make him more popular. It's like arresting Tupac Shakur. He's just going to sell more albums. And that is 100% accurate. That's exactly what's going to happen if Donald Trump does get arrested.
So that was Mark Kay on the supposedly impending arrest of Donald Trump, although it keeps getting put off day after day after day. So, but the point is that, again, he's making predictions. He and other people are making predictions. If you do this, then that's going to happen. No, don't do that. Don't bother to make predictions. What we want to do, if we're going to change the culture and then change our politics, is make value statements. We talk about what should happen. And I've talked about who it is that should win the nomination for the Republican Party, and that's Donald Trump, and who it is that should win the presidency outright, and that is Donald Trump. And I've explained why, because he deserves it. And he deserves it because he has the experience. Nobody else in the Republican field has the experience. And he is a promise keeper. He bothers to make promises, and he keeps those promises. No other politician does that. So those are the reasons that he deserves to be president and why he should be reelected. And that's what they should be talking about in this particular situation. Why should Donald Trump be prosecuted, or why should he not be prosecuted? If everything that I understand is that it's so, the case is so flimsy, and my understanding is that the federal government doesn't want anything to do with it. The Department of Justice doesn't want anything to do with this issue. So then the New York the district attorney should not pursue it either. And Donald Trump should not be arrested or prosecuted. So it should be on the merits. If Donald Trump has done something that's wrong, if he's done something that's illegal and that truly warrants an arrest and prosecution, fine. Why? Because he's a citizen just like the rest of us. And we have nobody that's above the law. And so that would be a situation where, of course, if it's appropriate, that's the watchword for the true conservative is appropriate. And in this case, it seems as though it's not appropriate. And so, therefore, he should not be indicted. I'm hoping that the grand jury will have the courage to tell the district attorney no and hand him a bill of no indictment. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. And now I want to read a couple of paragraphs from a book called The Genesis of Political Correctness, The Basis of a False Morality by Michael William. Let's see. Where is it here? Let's see. The Pure... No, not that. Yet. We'll get there. Here it is. And this is from the chapter called Repressive Tolerance. Okay, the conclusion reached is that the realization of the objective of tolerance would call for intolerance toward prevailing policies, attitudes, opinions, and extension of tolerance to policies, attitudes, and opinions which are outlawed or suppressed. In other words, today tolerance appears again as what it was in its origins at the beginning of the modern period, a partisan goal, a subversive, liberating notion and practice. And let's see what else we got here. This pure toleration of sense and nonsense is justified by the Democratic argument that nobody, neither group nor individual, is in possession of the truth and capable of defining what is right and wrong, good and bad. Therefore, all contesting opinions must be submitted to the people for its deliberation and choice. In other words, reality doesn't exist. Reality is what the majority says it is. It's a subversion of democracy. When a magazine prints side by side a negative and positive report on the FBI, it fulfills honestly the requirements of objectivity. However, the chances are that the positive wins because the image of the institution is deeply engraved in the mind of the people. Or if a newscaster reports the torture and murder of civil rights workers in the same unemotional tone he uses to describe the stock market or the weather, or with the same great emotion with which he says his commercials, then such objectivity is spurious. More, it offends against humanity and truth by being calm where one should be enraged, by refraining from accusation where accusation is in the facts themselves. The tolerance expressed in such impartiality serves to minimize or even absolve prevailing intolerance and suppression. This is from a guy named Marcuse, who is part of the Frankfurt School. He was a Marxist. So, but this is the point of neutrality. And he's absolutely correct on the point that when you are, there's something outrageous going on, but you're reporting it as though it's, I don't know, you're reporting on the price of gasoline or something like that. When something outrageous is happening, you need to report it as being outrageous. It is outrageous. What is happening with President Trump, for instance. Now, many of the people on Fox and others have come out and said that this is outrageous, and that's good. They should do that. But there's still too much neutrality about what they're doing. And the reason that these folks are going ahead and being neutral is that because they think it gives them extra credibility, because they can say, look, I don't have any dog in the fight. This is why you should listen to me and take me seriously. And really, if you want people to listen to you and take you seriously, get rid of the profit motive. Nonprofit news. Back in a minute. Thank you. And now the next three covert emotional manipulation tactics.
19. Charm. They know what makes us laugh, what makes us fearful, what excites us, what turns us off, and above all, what makes us vulnerable. George Simon, PhD, psychologist and expert in character disturbances. Skilled manipulators excel at hiding their true character and presenting themselves as charming and seductive. If you think you would never fall for it, think again. All of us turn on the charm and put our best foot forward in a new relationship. But manipulators use charm to advance a hidden agenda. Manipulators use charm as a way to disarm you and gain your trust. They make you feel interesting, liked, valued, and appreciated. Skilled manipulators are socially intelligent con artists, adept at expressing interest in you and your welfare, and at opening up to you and appearing vulnerable. How can you tell the difference between benign charm and malicious charm? Listen to your gut instincts, according to Dr. George Simon. On his website, manipulativepeople.com, he writes, "Psychopaths and the other disturbed character types tend to exude a superficial charm or glibness in their interpersonal manner. It often goes unnoticed as the huge red flag it is, but it can be detected if you know just what to look for. The smoothness or social facility these individuals display is generally not matched by congruent and concomitant emotion. They may have a very easy way with words, but usually their smooth talk is not accompanied by any emotion that matches what they're saying, or that can be sensed and felt by others as genuine. Still, You can easily doubt your gut instincts, thinking that they must be genuine, and allow yourself to be unduly swayed. Once a malicious charmer disarms your gut instincts, you are basically defenseless. 20. Intentional forgetting. The manipulator pretends he or she forgot something that's important to you, such as an agreement, a promise, or a commitment, or even an ingredient you need for dinner that night that he agreed to pick up on his way over. The manipulator will look you in the eye and keep a straight face as they tell you they're sorry, but they simply forgot your request, and they don't recall making that agreement. When a manipulator forgets something, that is important to you. They are attempting to evade responsibility by blaming something out of their control. In addition, the manipulator is implying that whatever it was they forgot wasn't important enough for them to remember, and neither are you. 21. Brandishing anger, or traumatic one-trial learning. The manipulator will put on an act of intense anger for the purpose of shocking you into submission. This is called traumatic one-trial learning, because it will quickly train you to avoid confronting, upsetting, or contradicting the manipulator.
And that was next three of the 30 emotional manipulation tactics. Back in a minute. Thank you. And now a little bit of don't think, all new don't think of an elephant.
Part three, framing for specific issues. Chapter 7, Freedom Issues. One of the major mistakes made by the Democratic Party is to focus on election campaigns, but not on the constant framing of public discourse. All politics is moral. Voters vote on what they implicitly, automatically, and unconsciously believe to be right. In short, elections have everything to do with how biconceptuals have adopted the moral vision of one side or the other. And elections depend on the language voters hear and the images they see every day, not just during the campaigns. Democrats tend to address interests. Kitchen table economics and the objective facts affecting the interests of middle class and poor voters. Yet poor conservatives and biconceptuals regularly vote against their interests. Many Tea Party voters are poor or made poorer by conservative policies. But the conservative message machine is relentless and extends almost everywhere. Conservative messaging dominates everyday public discourse. And the domination of everyday public discourse, at least as much as the domination of electoral discourse, determines our political realities. Conservatives have come to own the words freedom and liberty. These words weigh heavily in the conservative vocabulary. These words are among the most powerful in our politics because the centrality of the concept of freedom to democracy. Conservatives have no right to that ownership. Words have contestable meanings, and the word freedom means very different things to progressives than to conservatives. As I pointed out in Whose Freedom, freedom is a contested concept. Conservatives and progressives use the word to opposite effects. As we have seen from a careful reading of the original Declaration of Independence documents, the progressive meaning is at the heart of our democracy, and it is time to take it back. Most of the issues in public discourse, both in elections and in everyday decision-making, come down to issues of freedom. Healthcare. Comedian Jimmy Kimmel sent an associate out onto a Los Angeles street corner with a microphone to ask passers-by a simple question. Which do you like better, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act? The overwhelming majority said they didn't like Obamacare, but thought that the Affordable Care Act was a good idea. Most did not know that they were the same thing. After all, different names typically refer to different things. How did they get the negative impression of Obamacare? After Obama was elected in 2008, but before he was inaugurated, he had a pollster do a survey of which provisions for his health care act would be most popular. A group of those provisions came in between 60 and 80% in popularity. They were the familiar ones. No preconditions, no caps, your college-aged child can be on your plan, and so on. These became the main provisions of the plan. The assumption was that if all the main provisions were popular, the whole plan would be popular. In other words, the popularity of the plan should depend on the popularity of the provisions of the plan. No conservative attacked those popular provisions. There was no conservative movement in favor of preconditions or caps, or against having your college-aged child on your plan. Instead, conservatives understood that politics is a matter of morality and decided to attack the plan on moral grounds. They chose two moral domains, freedom and life. On freedom, they attacked it as a government takeover. On life, they said it contained death panels. And they repeated government takeover and death panels over and over, month after month. And every time the president said it is not a government takeover, he used the words government takeover, which activated the idea of a government takeover in the brains of listeners, thus reinforcing the conservative attack. The conservatives also never used the name Affordable Care Act. Instead, they invented their own name, Obamacare, taking the emphasis off the affordability of health care and associating Obamacare with government takeover and death panels.
And that was Don't Think of an Elephant by George Lakoff. And when he goes, one of the things that jumped out at me here, because most of this, what he's talking about is, of course, rather old. But one of the things that jumped out at me was when he was talking about how conservatives and conservative messages are dominating public discourse. And at first, you might want to think that it, because it sounds almost like an accusation, but this is the way they like to do things. They like to make a statement of truth because conservative discourse does dominate, and it should, as it should. There's nothing wrong with that. But tone of voice, he makes it sound as though through tone of voice that there's something wrong with the idea of conservatives and conservative messages dominating discourse. So that's one of the things you want to look out for. Good homework assignment is that when you're out, listen for it. Listen for it on television. Listen on the radio. Listen when you're talking to people. Listen for somebody that's making a statement of fact, but using tone of voice to try to manipulate the listener, to try to get them to be on the defensive, to try to get them to apologize or explain. Because once you start explaining, there's a saying in debate, once you explain, you lose. Keep that in mind. Back in a minute.
Brotherhood.
This is Ron, your host, the only true conservative in the United States today, bidding adios to all the butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers out there. So I'm reminding you that the left has no authority, no power, and they can't win.